to the next topic, which will be group theory, which will occupy us for the rest of the lectures. I would like to know whether there is any question about what we have done so far. Is there any doubts on complex analysis? Anything you did not understand that you would like me to repeat once again? Any particular doubt on the harmonic oscillator? Nothing? Did you have time to review? Everything is clear now? Yeah? Awesome. Very good. So, as I told you in the very beginning, group theory will involve, there is no way we can escape that, quite a big deal, quite a lot of definitions. So we'll have to introduce a lot of definitions. Well, a lot for some standards. But we have to develop some vocabulary, some language to be able to proceed. So I will try to introduce the concepts as we move along. And the idea is that we will start by, in the first two or three lectures, we will only focus on the groups that I asked you if you knew about in the handout yesterday. Namely, we will be confining ourselves to the orthogonal and the unitary groups, SO3 and SU2 for now. Okay? Good. So, please tell me whether I'm using concepts that you don't know, or whether I'm going too fast or too slow. Please help me tune the speed at which I should go. So let me remind you that SO3, what is SO3? Can someone tell me what SO3 is? Good. That's one possible definition. Eduardo was saying it's the group, it's the set of matrices which are orthogonal and have unit determinants of size 3. Okay? That's one possible definition. But I want a group theoretical definition of what a group is. So SO3, more abstractly, is the group of rotations in three-dimensional space. Okay? So SO3 is the set of proper rotations in three-dimensional space. Okay? Of course, everyone knows what rotations are. Proper is related to the fact that we allow only transformations which preserve the orientation. We don't allow for reflections. And that's what a proper rotation means. Okay? So, of course, we understand this is an abstract concept. It doesn't care about matrices, about vectors, about anything. This is just each element is a rotation. Okay? Is it clear? So a rotation is an element inside this set. So how can we parameterize? So how to parameterize the elements in SO3? Well, the answer is simple. For example, we can have a vector theta, so that the direction of theta tells you the axis of rotation, and the magnitude of theta will tell you the angle of rotation. Again, let me emphasize, I'm not making any references to matrices, to three-dimensional matrices. This is purely an abstract concept. This, I give you a theta, I'm giving you an element in the set of rotations. The direction where theta points is the axis around which I will apply my rotation. And the size of the vector is the angle of rotation. So the size of the vector would go between 0 and 2 pi. Okay? Now, something trivial about this set of rotations, which is that if we have two elements, so from two elements, okay, sorry, let me write again. So, given two elements, we can compose them to get a third element. We just apply the rotation twice. A third element in this group. So let me call it G. This is the set of proper rotations in three-dimensional space. Given two rotations, of course, I get a third rotation. If I rotate a solid twice, it's the same as a new rotation of the solid. Okay? The composition, this composition, is associative. Okay? So it means that if I have an element, if I combine an element theta with an element theta prime, this would mean composition. If I have three elements, if I'm composing three rotations, theta, theta prime prime, this is equal to theta composed. And I can decide first to consider what's the effect of these two rotations and then compose it with a third, of course, right? So if I do one rotation, then another rotation, this is some rotation, and then I compose with a third one. Right? So I'm only saying a couple of obvious things. So let me write this, not in this way, but let me say that the elements, so these thetas, I will also call them G's, the set of thetas. So in other words, this relation I can also write that G composed with G prime, composed with G prime prime, is equal to G composed with G prime, composed with G prime prime. Okay? Sorry? Here? No. No, I don't want to put brackets. Why would I want to put brackets? Yeah, I can do this once, or I can do... This is what associative means. Right? No, the brackets don't matter. That's what I was saying. Yeah. The brackets don't matter. Okay, so there are two rotations. I can get a third rotations. The rotations are, of course, associative. There is an inverse. So for each G, there is a G minus 1, right? If I rotate, you can rotate back to the same position. And there is an identity. Right? This is, of course, rotate back. And this is, of course, rotate zero angles, or not rotate at all. Okay? Now, the set of these properties, if I have a set G, with some element G which obey these properties, this is the definition of a group. Okay? So SO3 is a group. It's a set of elements which can be composed. The composition is associative. Whenever I compose, I can go back. And there is the possibility of not doing anything, which is the identity. So SO3 is our first group. Can you tell me some examples of more groups? Let's try to make a list of groups that you might know. So more groups. So we have seen SO3, which are rotations in three dimensions. This is a group. More examples. SU2, that one we will learn about a bit later. Let me not mention what it, let me not discuss in detail what it is, but simpler groups. that's true indeed. Yeah, that's good. But let's consider slightly more complicated stuff. Permutation, someone told me. Permutations here, let me first one by one. So permutations, right? I have some group of elements, I can permute them, and then and then I can rearrange them back, so I can go back to the previous rearrangement, so there is an inverse. If I can shuffle, then shuffle, and then shuffle, and of course, the result of shuffling three times is shuffling once after shuffling the two times. And there is an inverse, and there is the identity permutation, which, given a set of elements, leaves them in the same position. So of course, permutations is a group. Symmetries of polyhedra also, but that one I don't want to focus too much on finite groups. Something even simpler, for example, multiplication. Addition, right? All these are groups. You give me two elements, I can multiply them. You give me two elements, I can sum them. Maybe let me just mention one more. For example, SO2. What would SO2 be? Rotations in the two-dimensional plane. So this would be rotations in two dimensions. Okay? Now, instead of being very rigorous, defining the several properties, let me mention some obvious things. Permutations of n elements. Let me write permutations. Let the group, we call them Sn. This means of n elements. Okay. So, for example, the group of permutations here, this group is a finite group. There is only a finite number of elements. For example, if I have three elements to permute, there are three factorial possibilities. So there are three factorial elements. So there is a finite number of elements, and this is what is called a finite group. SO3, for example, no, I can rotate infinitesimally, and I have a continuous group. Okay? SO2, rotations in the two-dimensional plane, has an important difference compared to rotations in a three-dimensional plane. Can someone guess what I'm thinking about? Exactly. So rotations in a plane, I can rotate, then rotate a bit more, then rotate a bit more, and of course they commute, right? I can rotate first 30 degrees and then 10 degrees, or first 10 degrees and then 30 degrees, and I get the same thing. So rotations commute in the plane. So this is what is called an abelian group. Who else is abelian in this list? Sorry? Addition, of course, is abelian, and multiplication. Yes. Okay? So this will be all examples of abelian groups. Okay? Yes.
Multiplication group be like multiplied by number
x? No, an element would be just like when you make multiplication table 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 9. The elements are the elements 1 up to 9. And then you multiply, you list all the integers, for example. Let's see, multiplication in the integers. Each element is an integer. Right, because you give me an integer, I multiply by that integer. If I give me two integers, I compose to get the third integer, which is the multiplication of the two integers. Sorry? Okay, integer no. Sorry, forget. Yeah. Good, good.
But
no, integer no. But
element
yeah.
is a number that you multiply with.
Absolutely. Good, yeah. Of course, no. Integers was a bad example, of course. Yeah, so that's a good example. Yeah. Integers, multiplication is a good example of what I cannot do. Because if I multiply two integers, I cannot go back. Exactly, yeah. Good. Something. SO2 is contained in SO3. Rotations in two dimensions are a particular case of rotation in three dimensions. Right? If I'm rotating the three-dimensional space, I can decide to do rotations only along the axis Z. And those are the rotations of the plane. So SO2 is a subgroup. It's a group which is inside another one, so it's a subgroup of SO3. Okay? So here are a couple of important notions. Abelian groups which commute, which the elements, the operations commute. Subgroup, when you have a group inside another group. Finite group, when the number of elements of a group is finite. Continuous group, when there is some continuous parameters, like the angle of rotation. And SN, permutations of S elements. This is also useful to know what it is. Good. Okay, so we introduced a lot of vocabulary. In general, more generally, about rotations, SON is associated, of course, to rotations are the elements which define rotations in RN. Okay? So, okay. Now, as we were discussing, in practice, a group, so we can basically, in practice, a group is equal to a multiplication table. That is, we have some composition, and we have the set of elements, and we have here some rotation, theta, some other rotation, theta prime, and we get when we compose some rotation, theta prime prime. And we compose theta. If we compose theta prime prime with theta, we get some other rotation, theta prime prime prime. And if you give me this multiplication table, I know how to compose the elements because the composition is associative. So whenever I multiply two of them, I get a third here. Okay? And of course, it's not associative, so it's not abelian. So if I have here theta prime and theta, it's not the same as theta theta prime, so here I don't have theta prime prime in this element. I would have some theta prime 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 prime. Okay, some other element. So, which is of course not equal to this. Okay, any questions so far? I know that for a big percentage of you, everything I've said so far is quite trivial. But, is everything clear? Good. Now, in practice, we have a very useful way of thinking about rotation in three-dimensional space. There is a nice way, if you want, of composing and of seeing the rotation in three-dimensional space, which is by writing rotation matrices. We pick vectors in the space, and then we see what is the action on those vectors, and we represent the action by matrices. Okay? So a useful way of parametrizing the elements, which is less abstract, if you want. Is by introducing matrices. So we can, for each element G inside SO3, we have a matrix D of G, okay, such that let me write first the matrices. What are they? You know very well. So for example, a rotation around the element theta in the direction Z, this you saw, I think you even saw in Nima's lectures, this would be the rotation cosine theta, sine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta, 0, 0, and this element here will not change. So is this clear to everyone? This would be the rotation, for example, along one particular element, right? This is one particular element. One particular element G. And for each element, we have a rotation matrix. Is this okay? Good. Now, given two elements, what do these rotation matrices obey? Well, they mimic the group. If you pick two elements, D of G1, I wrote, and D of G2, now this is a multiplication. It's not a composition. This is really a matrix multiplication here, not composition. Everyone knows how to multiply matrix. This is just matrix multiplication. This is, of course, the matrix of the composition. And now here it's composition in the abstract sense of our multiplication table. And this property holds, of course, right? If you give me a rotation of VZ and a rotation of VX, I am getting a third rotation, which is the honest rotation that I get after composing the two rotations. Okay? This is what is called a representation. So a representation of a group G is a map that maps each element of G into a linear operator and linear operator, what's a linear operator? It's a fancy way of saying matrix in practice. Sometimes it's not a matrix, sometimes it might be a differential operator, but in practice most of the time it's a matrix. Okay, almost always it's a matrix. So for each element, I give you a matrix such that these properties hold. D of G1, D of G2 is equal to D of G1 composed with G2. Okay? Now, this particular representation, it's a representation of SO3 of dimension, can you still write here? Can you still read here? Of dimension 3. 3, why 3? 3 is the size of the matrix. Okay? So this is the dimension of a representation. Okay. Is the representation as good as the group? Does the representation carry as much information as the group? Does this representation carry as much information as the group? Of course. If you give me the matrices, I multiply, I see what's the new matrix. So of course, I can compose the matrices and get any possible rotation. But not always. So there are boring representations and interesting representations. Okay? So, for example, a trivial representation. This is another important concept. A trivial representation is, for example, D of G being the identity matrix. For each element, you map it to the identity matrix. So, of course, this property is true, right? If you give me any two elements, I multiply them, I multiply two identity matrices, I get an identity matrix which is D of any element. So for any element, it's always the identity matrix. Of course, this representation, if I give you, I'm giving you a group and the representation is D of G is equal to the identity. Now guess what group I'm talking about? Of course, you cannot. So there are what are called good representations and bad representations. And I forgot the name, the rigorous name. But it's obvious what I mean, right? So there are representations which faithful, good. So this is a faithful representation. Faithful, which means I can reconstruct the multiplication table. And this is a trivial representation or a non-faithful representation where I cannot reproduce the multiplication table. So faithful, if you give me a faithful representation, I can tell you exactly, I can make a multiplication table and forget about matrices and then think again abstractly. Okay? Good. Now, of course, there are several ways of you could give me, it's easy to give me another representation of SO3. Okay? It's easy if you have a representation of SO3 to give me another one. Just change your bases, rotate your bases of vectors. Right? Instead of considering X, Y, Z, rotate a bit the axes and the matrices rotate. Right? This gives you another representation. The matrices look a bit different because you are choosing a different basis. Right? But this is like cheating. I mean, it's the same thing. I just rotated the bases. Come on. It's not really a new representation, right? So representations are set equivalent. So two representations are set equivalent. In other words, if D prime of G is equal to S D of G S minus 1 for any G. This is what I get if I make a change of variables, right? If I rotate my bases, then my D primes transform in that way. Finally, another important definition is that of unitary transformations, unitary representations. So unitary representations are those where the matrix of the element G minus 1 is D of G dagger. Okay, it's the definition of a unitary transformation. Okay. Sorry. Yes.
Injection between the group elements and.
Faithful representation is a bijection between the group elements.
Stay injective.
It needs to be injective, yeah. Not bijective, yeah. It could be. Let's see an example of a faithful representation now, which is not a bijection. The point is that there must be at least as much information, but there could be redundant information. Right? Okay. Good. Any questions so far? Okay, so everyone knows what a group is. A group is a multiplication table. A representation is a map. Each element of that group goes to a matrix. And I can just recover the multiplication table or if the representation is faithful by multiplying those matrices. Matrices of rotations in SO3, everyone could write them down, right? I don't need to be writing down rotations of SO3, right? Everyone knows how to rotate vectors in SO3. And okay, so I think for now that's all we need. Now, let's build some bigger representation of SO3. Let's talk a bit about tensor representations. Okay. So, let's pick two vectors and construct a matrix out of these two vectors. So let's define the tensor Tij, which is defined just as the component xi and yj. Okay? So I have a vector x, which is x1, x2, and x3, and the vector y, which is y1, y2, and y3, and I construct a matrix Tij, which is just xi times xj. Okay? Now, this is a matrix. I can think of this object, of course, as a vector. What is the size of this vector? How many components this vector has? 9, right? 3 times 3. I and j take 3 values. So I can think of this as a 9-dimensional vector. Okay? This object is like a 9-dimensional vector. Now, under rotations, Tij is transformed, because xi and yj are transformed, into R I prime R J. Okay, sorry. Let me put. Sorry, do you mind if I raise the indices? Or it's too late? Let me raise the indices. Sorry, I prefer to have them raised. It doesn't matter. It's Euclidean. You can. The position of the indices is absolutely equivalent. It is just. To avoid doing mistakes when writing formulas. If you don't like, leave them down and put all the indices down. R I prime, R j j prime, x I prime, y j prime. This is clear. J prime. Of course, I'm. Okay. Sorry, D and D. The rotation matrices were called D. Of course, we are used to calling them R, so it's possible that sometimes I write R instead of D. Correct me if I do so. So I have some, each of them is just transformed into this way. So this is that this part is a transformation of x I prime, and this part is a transformation of y into y prime. Is this clear, that this is the rotation? And this is, of course, this object. I'm just putting brackets, nothing else. Dj, j prime, acting on t, I prime, j prime. Okay? Yes?
Are we using the summation convention?
I am using the summation convention, sorry. Okay, so of course, yeah. Good one. But please do cool. When I have something with some indices, I, B with some indices, I, this is the same as sum from I equal 1 up to whatever makes sense, in this case 3, of the same stuff. Okay? And this, I can think as some big matrix, D, let me call them D big, whose elements are I, J, I prime, J prime, acting on T, I prime, J prime. Okay? So let me write T, I, J is transformed into some big matrix times it itself. So this is a 9-dimensional vector is equal to some d big times this 9-dimensional vector. Right? If I think of Tij as a 9-dimensional vector. So what would you say this d big is? This is a representation again. Right? If I rotate two elements, I get 2D bigs, which I have to multiply. But it's a bigger representation. It's not a representation of size 3, of dimension 3. This is a dimension 9 representation. So this is nine. Okay? Now, is someone confused with these manipulations? Is this clear to everyone? Good. Now, actually, writing it as a nine-dimensional vector and just saying that the representation is nine-dimensional, in some sense, is a bit misleading. Because we know that Tij can be broken, can be divided into nice parts. There are nice things, nice combination of indices, which I can make, which decompose this tensor into nice components. For example, Tij, I can write it as the symmetric part plus the anti-symmetric part. Right? Let me write the formula and then let's discuss it. So let Tij be the trace delta ij times sum over k tkk plus the anti-symmetric part Tij minus Tji over 2 plus the symmetric traceless part Tij plus Tji over 2 minus 1 third sum over k Tkk. Delta ij over 3, sorry. Tkk. Okay? So we pick this tensor and we write its trace parts, the anti-symmetric tensor and the symmetric and traceless. Okay? And now, my Tij, my nine-dimensional vector, it's equal to the trace. Now I choose this basis, trace. Then I put the anti-symmetric vector here. And then I put the symmetric traceless. What's the size of each of these parts? What's the size of the trace? There's only one element in the trace, right? There are three elements in the antisymmetric, and there are five elements in the symmetric traceless. Is it clear? So in the trace, there's only one element, just the identity times the trace. For the antisymmetric, I have 3 times 2 over 2 choices, which is 3. Right? So for this, I have 3 for the first index I, times 2, and because it's antisymmetric, over 2. This is the number of independent components I have. And here, I have the remaining ones, which is 9 minus 4, which I can also think symmetric traceless matrices. It's also obvious that it is... okay. It's just 9. It's the remaining ones. Okay? There are several ways of counting, of course. Symmetric matrices, I can say that I consider n square, n is 3. I consider n square, this gives me all the elements. I sum n to consider the diagonal now is counted twice. I divide by 2, now I get half of the elements. It was important to add n so that the diagonal is counted twice. Now I have half of them, and I subtract 1 because it's traceless. Okay, and this gives 5, I hope, when n is equal to 3. Let's see, 9 plus 3, 12, 12 over 2, 6, 6 minus 1, 5, yeah. Good. But this is an obvious counting, you just count how many there are. And now, in this basis, right, in this basis, how does this matrix DD looks like? So in this basis, this DB is equal to a one-dimensional representation here, a 3x3 block here, and a 5x5 block here, and then zeros everywhere else. Yes?
I'm not sure. Well, you're saying that you take the whole trace, and if you say in that formula, if you say t of 1, 1, then you're going to have delta 1, 1 times the trace.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So we're going to have the each of the diagonal elements is going to be the whole trace. Like that, instead of just being its own component.
Let me see if I understand your question. So, I'm just decomposing Tij. How many elements do you need to give me? N, 9, right? So, I'm telling you, give me the trace of the matrix, give me its anti-symmetric parts, and give me its symmetric part and traces. These are the 9 elements you need, the 9 bits of information that you need to give me. Right? This is a basis. I rotate and I pick this basis. Now, an identity, this trace here, how does it transform when I rotate it? Doesn't transform at all. Right? This anti-symmetric part, when I rotate, the elements rotate among themselves. And the symmetric and traceless part, when I rotate them, they rotate among themselves. So the representation in this basis becomes of this block diagonal form. This is something that you can check explicitly picking these rotation matrices and understanding why does it decompose into these blocks. So if you want, let me put as homework. I will explain in a while, check in detail. Okay. Yes.
No, it's missing one third on the first trace.
Let me see.
It's said to be traceless then.
There is no 3 in the last one. Let me see, is this guy traceless or not? When I take the trace, I get trace, and I get 3 times the trace. So let me put a 1/3 here. I prefer. Okay? I want that guy to be traceless. So the traceless objects transform and turn themselves into traceless objects. Okay, good. So what we saw is that naively we have a big object, but then by a change of variable, we can decompose its action into this block diagonal form. So this representation, in some bases it might look like all the elements are non-zero, but there is a basis, this one, where the matrices decompose into block diagonal form. Okay? When this happens, the representation is denoted as to be completely reducible, when it's possible to reduce it to block diagonal form. So this is a completely reducible representation. Okay? And the block which is not possible to reduce anymore, D of G, which we cannot reduce, which is not possible by a change of variable to put it in block diagonal form. And this is the case for this guy, for each of these 3 guys. Is an irreducible representation. And these irreducible representations are typically just, we only mention IREP. IREP stands for irreducible representation. Okay? So they are the building blocks if you want, it's obvious. Because if you give me a representation, either it's irreducible, or it can be divided into irreducible representations. Okay? And what we have seen in this example, that you pick a tensor, and then you notice that there are blocks in this tensor that transform into themselves and don't mix when I do rotations, is what's called a tensor product of a representation decomposing into its irreducible parts. So all we have done can be summarized into a nice formula, which tells you that 3 times 3 is equal to 1 plus 3 plus 5. And this is understood each number here is the dimension of the representation. And this formula tells you pick two vectors, tensor them, and you get a scalar, a symmetric traceless, and an antisymmetric tensor. Okay? So what we have seen is typically summarized in such formulas, where typically we put this letter to be boldface. In the books you would see this will be some boldface numbers to indicate that they refer to dimensions of representations. So this is what you will see in many books.
So the 3 on the right-hand side is not one of the 3s on the left-hand side. So the notation doesn't take it. The left-hand side, they're vectors, and the right-hand side, they're not really vectors. They're tensors or vectors.
Okay, if you want, in our example, yes. But... But actually, it's the same representation. This 3 is the same, because under the change of variable, this antisymmetric is just a vector. Okay. Okay. So let me maybe... Okay. Let's understand a bit why... I think this is more or less... Probably you could all prove this by just transforming these objects and seeing that they transform among themselves. Let's see, for example, the one-dimensional representation. So I want to make a statement that delta ij and epsilon ijk are SO3 invariant tensors. Okay? They are SO3 invariant tensors. So what does it mean? It means that if I transform this tensor according to that rule, according to this dii prime, dij prime, delta ii prime, I prime j prime, this is equal to the same thing. It doesn't transform at all. And similarly, if I transform this epsilon ijk, it goes to dii prime, djj prime, dkk prime, epsilon I prime, j prime, k prime, and it doesn't transform. It's just epsilon ijk. Now, why are these properties true? How could we check them? One way is to notice, to pick the rotation matrix explicitly and check that these relations are true. Right? Understand what are the properties of the rotation matrix and see that they are true. But these relations are obviously true because these objects have a nice geometrical interpretation. Because the statement one is equivalent, of course, to saying that x dot y is invariant. Okay? X dot y is xi, delta ij. It's x contracted with y with a delta function, and the fact that the delta function doesn't change would mean that this inner product doesn't change. And why shouldn't this inner product change? Because it's an angle. It's an angle between two vectors. Now I rotate space-time, of course the scalar product between the two vectors doesn't change. Right? So of course this should not change, because this is just the size of the vector, cosine of the angle. So of course it should not change. So of course it's obvious that if I will transform this object, it is invariant, and this translates into the condition that delta ij is invariant. And the second condition, the vector is invariant because delta ij is what ensures that if you give me 3 generic vectors, and if out of the 3 vectors I construct this solid here, okay, epsilon ij invariant is the statement that the volume of this object here is invariant. Okay? You can think a bit why this is true, but It's just because this product of three vectors with an epsilon symbol gives the volume of this object. And of course, again, if I rotate my space, this object rotates, but of course its volume is invariant, and therefore epsilon ijk should be invariant. Okay? So what is this, the trace component? The trace component, this trace, the trace is nothing but the inner product, x dot y, right? This is the sum over k of tkk. And of course, the trace is invariant. So of course, it doesn't change when I apply my rotations. So of course, this d, 1 tensor 1, this d of size 1 by 1 is just the number 1. Okay? So the trace doesn't change at all. Okay? What about the anti-symmetric parts? How can I think of the anti-symmetric parts? Okay? The anti-symmetric part, there are three components. There is the component T, let me write them, T2, 3, T3, 1, and T1, 2. Okay? These are three independent components. All other ones are just given by minus these three. And this is what? This is proportional to what? This is proportional to T23, which is x2, y3, minus x3, y2. This one, x3, y1, minus x1, y3. And the last one, x1, y2, minus x2, y1. And this is nothing but the vector product between x and y. Right? Which is another vector, which I can define as z. So of course, if you give me two vectors, I make the vector product, I get a third vector. And now, under rotations, I can just think, where is this vector going? And these rotations, the fact that it forms a block is just telling me it's the rotations of this new vector obtained by the product of by two vectors. So given two vectors, I can make a vector product and get a third vector, and then I have rotations of this third vector. And this is, of course, a three-dimensional representation because it's exactly the same we started with. So this answers your question that this three is the same as this three. Okay? And this tensor is a symmetric trifold combination, and you can also see that it transforms it's obvious now that this part is like this, and now you have just the rest, so the rest you put there, and you can check that when you act by rotations, you don't generate anti-symmetric stuff, which is more or less obvious because D is symmetric. This D big is symmetric. So when you act here, you cannot generate stuff, and therefore you get the zeros on the other line. No, sorry. You get zeros here, and you cannot get anything proportional to the identity, so you get zeros there. But in any case, you can check that when acting with rotations here, that you stay within objects of this form. You see? I could also do it here, but I just gave you a faster argument. I just gave you a geometrical meaning for this, and therefore it's obvious from this geometrical meaning that the elements rotate among themselves, right? I rotate the vector z, I'm always in the space of vector z. So I don't get out of this space of these anti-symmetric tensors. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, good. Any question? Why did I lower the indices? Ah, by mistake. Yeah. Of course, yeah. This should be upper indices. It doesn't matter because it's Euclidean, so index up and down doesn't have any meaning. Still, it's often useful to write them in the right position because you don't make mistakes when you write. You know that when you write this, then you know that these indices should appear up, and therefore, if you You don't do any mistake and you don't put wrong indices here. Yes?
So I think I don't quite understand yet what it means to reduce a representation like that. Does it mean you actually get something lower dimensional out?
Exactly. It means that if I give you that nine-dimensional representation in terms of these elements, and if I put them in a vector, T11, T12, etc., you get rotation matrices which look like all the elements are non-zero. But this doesn't mean much, because it just means that you chose the wrong basis. There was another basis, which was this one here, which is a rearrangement of your original basis, where these rotations take this form for any G. For any element of the group, the representation decomposed, and there are subspaces in your space where the representation acts.
But that is still a nine-dimensional matrix.
This is still a nine-dimensional matrix, but it decomposes into smaller blocks which don't mix among themselves. So there are subspaces. So it's more useful to study the smaller subspaces. They are the more fundamental building blocks, so they don't mix with each other.
Each of the subspaces somehow degenerate or something.
No, degenerate in what sense?
So I don't understand how the dimension here is reduced. I don't know. No one else.
So there are nine. So you have nine elements, right? But then consider the combination. Do this change of variable. You have these components of your vector, T11, etc. Now consider, for example, this change of variable, which one of the coordinates you consider as the sum of the diagonal elements. T11 plus T22 plus T33 plus T44. Okay, no, T33. So, yeah? So sum of three elements. T11 plus T22 plus T33. Now rotate this element. You always get this element back. Because if you rotate T11 plus T12 plus T23, this is just x dot y. Rotate it, you get x dot y again. So any rotation that you choose, a rotation along z, along x, along y, along some diagonal axis, whatever, this combination always transforms back to itself. Right? And therefore, if you represent it as a matrix, and if your first element of your vector is this T11 plus T22 plus T33, this element never rotates to lower components. It always stays here. There's always a 1 here, and that vector is in that point, is that subspace is invariant. Right? So there is a one-dimensional subspace, which is the space of possible traces, which doesn't mix with the other invariant subspaces. Please tell me if you have other questions. Yes? The symmetric and traceless? The symmetric and traceless, the components would be again parametrized by, would be given by this. There would be five possible components here.
Does it have an easier interpretation like this?
Let me think. Symmetric and traceless. I don't think it has a nice geometrical interpretation. Maybe someone knows, but
like stress and strain tensor is.
So symmetric and traceless, nice geometrical interpretation. No, not at all. I will think about it. Okay, so let me think. I want to. So again, let me just write it one more time. So a representation is reducible if it has an invariant subspace. Okay, so if these linear operators, they act on some subspace, and if they don't touch it. So if there is some space where these vectors are acting, and by acting with any D, you always stay within this subspace, which is the case here. If you pick me these three subspaces and you act with rotations, you always stay within those subspaces. A reducible is one which has an invariant subspace. Okay? Okay. Good. Now, there it is possible, of course, as we said in the very beginning, to define the groups, and Eduardo even proposed to define SO3 right from the beginning in that way, by a faithful representation. So another definition of SO3, an equivalent definition of SO3, an equivalent definition of SON is, and of course here I'm being a bit sloppy because I'm defining rather a representation, but it's faithful and therefore it's equivalent to the definition of the group. So I'm rather defining, if you want, a faithful representation of SON. Okay? It's can given by the set of matrices R. So N by N matrices, such that R transpose times R is equal to the identity, and determinant of R is equal to 1. Okay? This is more or less, this is, I think, clear though. This condition here is just the previous statement that delta ij is left invariant, which, as we saw, is equivalent to the statement that these are transformations which preserve the scalar product between two vectors. So, of course, this mathematical definition makes sense physically. Okay? Okay. So, again, if we have x dot y, it would transform. So this is, of course, the same as saying x transpose dot y, in the sense that I have a vector and a column and a row. And therefore, and this would transform into rx transpose dot ry, which would be equal to x transpose R transpose R times Y, which is equal to X transpose dot identity dot Y, which is just the original X dot Y. Okay? So this is a good definition of what we call the group SON. The determinant of R condition being equal to 1 tells you that we preserve the orientation. So, for example, R, which will be 1, 1, minus 1, is, which basically flips the axis, flips the z-axis to be like this. This is just a reflection. So this is a reflection. It's forbidden because that's determinant equal to minus 1. It's obvious that the determinant should be either 1 or minus 1, right? Can someone tell me why? No? Because R transpose, so R transpose R equal to 1, if I take the determinant, it implies that determinant of R transpose R equal determinant of the identity. So, of course, this is equal to 1, and this is determinant of R square. And therefore, determinant of R should be 1 and minus 1. And what this condition does is it picks only the ones with plus 1. which are the ones which preserve the orientation. These are the ones which preserve this epsilon ijk. Okay? So if you impose that epsilon ijk contracted with R is nothing but the determinant of R, if you want it to be preserved, if you want to preserve the volume, you want therefore to have the determinant of R equal 1. Okay? You might not care, and in that case you define what's called the ON group, which is just defined by the set of matrices such that R transpose R is equal to the identity. Okay? Real matrices. They are real. Okay. Since we are defining this, it doesn't cost as much to define already what are the unitary groups, even though I think we are not going to use them today, probably, but I can define immediately SUN. SUN are the set of matrices. Here, normally, we use U. Now, these are complex matrices, not real. Complex N by N, such that U dagger U is equal to 1. And the S stands for special, which is always the matrices where determinant of U are equal to 1. Again, there were two choices in this case. And UN is defined by the complex N by N matrix such that U dagger U is equal to 1 without the condition that the determinant is equal to 1. Okay? So, the O and the SO, ON and the SON, are the, for the second case, it said special orthogonal groups. And SUN, no, and UN, or S and SUN, when I put the S, are the, again, if there is an S, this is what's called special unitary groups. Sorry? Okay, I concede. Good. Thank you. Any questions? No? Okay. So let's continue in 10 minutes.
Saying that delta ij is invariant under SO3.
Yes.
So you were saying that you prove that.